Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Europe titled The Global Environmental Crisis: Is There a Place for an Individual Response? Our speaker is Dr. Katya Vladimirova, visiting scholar at the center. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Henrik Selin, Associate Professor of International Relations at Boston University's Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies.
It's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Katya Vladimirova. In my own research, I focus on environment and sustainable development. And Dr. Vladimirova will come here and give a talk today with the title, The Global Environmental Crisis: Is There a Place for an Individual Response? And this is a question that I struggle with myself in my own research, but also teaching my own courses, because teaching courses on environmental politics can be a little bit depressing, because a lot of the trends are going in the wrong direction, and inevitably one student or another will always ask, so what can we actually do, right? What is it that we can do on an individual and a collective level to make this better? Now, Dr. Vladimirova holds a double PhD from two universities in Europe, one in Rome and one in Brussels. It was a joint program between the two, with a background in political science and political theory. So her own research focuses then on issues of environmental politics and ethics, with a focus on climate change and sustainable development more broadly. She finished her dissertation last fall, and she's currently hard at work of turning that dissertation into a book. In addition to her own research, she's also worked practically on some of the issues that she will be talking about today. She has worked for the Division of Sustainable Development within the United Nations Secretariat in New York City, and she's currently engaged in another project there, which is a project on education for sustainable development in the post-2015 development agenda, connected to efforts by UNESCO. So here today, she will talk about some of the arguments that she developed in her dissertation research, which has to do with individual responses to climate change as sort of part of a greater value shift towards valuing sustainability more. So most times when we talk about climate change, we do it from a scientific perspective or a political perspective or maybe economics or technological solutions or something like this, whereas the talk here today will focus more broadly on the need for a societal transformation towards better climate change mitigation and adaptation in a broader context of sustainable development. So she will then draw from different perspectives in her talk in environmental philosophy, climate ethics, social psychology, and international relations, and so forth.
Thank you very much, Professor Selin. The topic of today's presentation roughly encompasses my work that I've been doing in the past 4 years as part of my PhD and now as part of my book preparations. And it is indeed an interdisciplinary, it's an interdisciplinary study that was triggered by the question of individual moral motivation to act sustainably. As a child, I was very interested in different kind of engagement with nature. I went hiking with my parents, with my school, did a lot of work to clear up our own little town and things like that, and I was predisposed to be environmentally conscious, let's put it this way. And so when at some point I heard about, you know, global environmental crisis, I learned about the climate change, of course I wanted the global degradation to stop. However, it's quite obvious that as individuals what we do is not so much. Our contributions to the problem through our carbon footprint, as well as our actions to diminish this footprint, are incrementally small. And there is millions and billions of people caught up in a collective action problem, waiting for some structural changes, some political changes, technology breakthrough, innovations, and not always getting what we expect. So we can take shorter showers, buy fair trade products, stop driving a car, but this would not reverse climate change. And especially it's difficult to see when you are trying to do something and your neighbor is not doing the same thing or not doing anything at all. So even for people who are more inclined to act on climate change, on global environmental crisis, it's easy to get frustrated at some point, lose motivation, and stop doing. And if everyone stops doing something, then as a society, as humanity, we lose the battle. So at the heart of my dilemma, there was a problem of individual moral motivation. How, in light of all the discouragement, can people still find the motive to act sustainably? How can we justify and morally ground our actions? And what ethical arguments are there to support individual choice in favor of sustainable behavior as the right moral action? So answering these questions required me to go through quite a few disciplines, because there's no one discipline that offers on a plate a ready answer. I had to comb through environmental philosophy, climate ethics, sociology and social psychology, somewhat through international relations and the study of social movements. And I believe that the journey to answer these questions was as important as answering them, as answering the question itself. And I've developed, and today I would like to present you a kind of an interdisciplinary framework to address the question of individual moral motivation as part of a broader package of ethical challenges. So what I did was to look at the question of what really is the underlying level, like what directs our behavior. And the way I started thinking about this was after reading a very timely contribution to climate ethics written by Stephen Gardiner, which is called The Perfect Moral Storm. Stephen Gardiner is a philosopher, but he drew from a lot of very practical developments in sustainable development and climate change discussions. And he suggested that climate change can be interpreted as a set of three clusters of moral issues. A global storm, so spatial dimensions, relationships between countries, for example, more vulnerable, less vulnerable. Intergenerational storm, which encompasses issues of intergenerational solidarity. And theoretical storm. As an excellent philosopher, Gardiner argues that our moral theories right now are not really equipped to answer, to give us guidance on how to act on global environmental problems. So all these issues combined can be understood as a perfect moral storm to humankind. And I'm going to use this this term several times throughout my presentation. A perfect moral storm makes us vulnerable to moral corruption. Moral corruption is something that I believe deserves much more place in contemporary discussions about climate change. Moral corruption is not like any corruption. It's not like general corruption when someone takes bribes and does something to favor the position of the person who gave the bribe. Moral corruption is a way more subtle form. It's a corruption of our way of thinking about the problem. It can manifest itself in postponing thinking about climate change, or, for example, I will not recycle because my neighbor is not recycling, or we are going to leave dealing with this problem to our children and grandchildren who are going to come in some time. Things like this, when people are comfortable with the status quo, it's really difficult to overcome the existing situation. So we become morally corrupt to pass the buck, as Gardiner calls it, and we are become really vulnerable to moral corruption. How do we overcome moral corruption is the biggest question. And I decided to approach this challenge by appealing to values, because moral corruption and our actions, our behavior, attitudes, norms, they're all rooted and reinforced by our dominant system of values. Values are underlying moral principles, moral standards of an individual or a group. These are generally accepted or personally held judgment of what is valuable or important in life. This is the kind of meaning in which I was looking at values. You might have heard discussions about values in different disciplines, and indeed there is a lot of literature. It took me a while to understand that indeed values are understood very often in a different meaning. For example, economics and philosophy often looks at values as the regard that something is held to deserve, the importance, worth, or usefulness of something, including the material or monetary worth of something, the worth of something compared to the price paid to ask for it. So values, in that sense, is something that I leave to economists to decide and to work on. But I'm interested more in the cultural aspect of values. So moral standards, moral guidance, moral underpinnings of our actions. Before I say what's interesting, I want to say that several disciplines deal with values. Very interesting work has been done in sociology, and also an interesting contributions have been emerging recently from the discipline of climate ethics and environmental ethics. Sociology distinguishes between two types of values: personal or individual values, something that is held by each of us, and cultural or collective values, which is something that the society or a group of people agrees on. I'm sure in one way or another we all heard about this distinction, and it will be important in my argument. So I am not interested in values as an abstract category out there, discussions about what is valuable, what is not valuable. I'm interested in them because a lot of studies have proven that values indeed affect our behavior. Since the late 1980s, social psychologists have expressed a lot of interest in values, and they have conducted several important studies. One of the benchmark studies was the study by Stern from 2000, who has created a very clear theory called Values, Beliefs, Norms theory, by which he tries to prove, indeed convince quite a few people, that people with biospheric and altruistic value systems are more likely to engage into pro-environmental behavior, unlike people who hold primarily egoistic systems of values. I'm going to ask you at this point, would you like me to explain what these different systems of values are, or is it self-evident? I've been working on it for too long. I don't know if it's... So egoistic, altruistic, and biospheric value orientations. So three value orientations are what kind of inclination people have, what kind of mindsets a person has. Egoistic would be a value orientation that tends to focus on immediate interests, on self-interest of the person in question. And it doesn't have to do with necessarily, say, monetary incentives. The person can really worry about his family or his immediate community, but it's really all tied to the egoistic self, looking at how whatever action is going to affect the person. Altruistic value orientation tends to include other humans, not just immediate members of the community, but other people, for example, people living who are suffering from the consequences of climate change in some remote, vulnerable islands or from droughts in Africa. So this would be still very human-focused, anthropo-focused view, but it includes all of humanity, for example. And then there is a biospheric, really advanced, if we speak about sustainable development, really advanced value orientation. Biospheric value orientation tends to include not just humans, but also non-human animals, the planet as a whole. So people are concerned about nature, about animals in this nature, about preserving ecosystems. So social psychologists have proven that there are indeed you can differentiate people by these value orientations. It took longer than I thought, but basically the social psychologists have been arguing that our values affect our beliefs, And people with biospheric and altruistic value orientations tend to have more often ecological worldviews, and they understand adverse consequences for valued objects. So if you have an altruistic or biospheric value orientation, you tend to believe that, for example, your favorite forest where you used to hike with your family as a kid is going to be in danger because of climate change. And then people have, with these value orientations, have perceived ability to reduce threat. They're trying to reduce this threat. And that brings us to pro-environmental personal norms. So you get a sense of obligation that, indeed, if I can do something about it, I have to do it, because norms come with an ought to component. I ought to do something about it. And these pro-environmental norms, they result in several types of pro-environmental behavior, which could be activism, non-activist public sphere behavior, private sphere behaviors, and behavior in organization. All this was a long way to say that values indeed matter, and they do affect our behavior. And we should not dismiss this this link, and this link should probably encourage us to think more about not just changing behavior, which normally, as social psychologists say, normally it has a short-term effect. But if we change values which underpin unsustainable behavior, then these the results of these changes are going to be maybe that it will take longer, but they will also last longer. In my PhD and now currently in my book, I focused on a value shift and behavioral change. I defined a value shift towards sustainability, which is a term that appears here now and then in, you know, political speeches, in views of some philosophers, but there was no kind of definition. So I suggest a definition that a value shift is a change in personal and collective values, a transformation of value systems, emergence of some new and elimination of some old values. And here we can see if values change, that would trigger changes in behavior. And very interestingly, that's what I was going to say, but the interesting fact about values is that different disciplines, there's an interdisciplinary dissonance between perspectives from philosophy and from sociology. Philosophers are out there and they're telling us, we should change values. Values should change. Our current system of values is unsustainable. It should be changed. So philosophers see it as a fluid category, something that can and should change. And then we look at literature and sociology, and sociologists are telling, but these things don't really change. This is something that we rather hold as constant. This is something that we see hardly changes in within a person's lifetime. They are defined in an early stage of a person's life, and then it's very, very hard to change them. So bringing together these different disciplinary perspectives was very interesting, because how can we have a really strong normative call to change something when empirically it's proven that it's very hard to change? So I started digging more into that, and I looked at the individual value shifts and collective value shifts, so the difference between the personal and cultural values. If sociologists tell us it is very difficult to change, I still wanted to know what are the ways of changing values. The findings were that the way the argument was developing was that personal values tend to change through three mechanisms, at least. Self-reflection, this really takes a person as a very active agent. Deliberation with others, we speak about what we think is important. We look at our role models, we look at people who we respect, and sometimes we tend to take their values and start sharing their values because someone we respect holds these values. And finally, there is a very important role of personal experience. If the person has survived Hurricane Katrina, or if the person has been exposed to clearly climate-related disasters, it is more likely, as again social psychologists tell us, that the person's underlying beliefs and values change. Personal values have strong connections with personal and social norms. this is a topic for a different talk, but I still would like to underline it, and with virtues and moral character. And when I was trying to find this way of how do we encourage the person to do something, like why would, how should individual values change? What should be triggering this intention to do something sustainable? I thought a very promising way to address this issue was by engaging with the issue of moral character. Moral character, indeed, is it's a philosophy domain, and philosophers tell us Ronald Sandler, who's actually in Boston as well. He works on sustainability virtues. He wrote a book about environmental virtues and sustainability virtues, and about the importance of working on individual moral character, again, through self-reflection, through deliberation, through imitating of role models. If we believe that something is virtuous, if we believe that something is the right thing to do, then it is more likely that we engage into this action. The problem is, with climate change, it's very hard to say what is the right thing to do, right? Sometimes there's a lot of uncertainty, lots of things are very vague, there are still debates going on about whether, for example, unplugging your charger is a good thing to do or not. And it's very hard sometimes to get a solid moral guidance of what the right thing to do is. But I believe that by engaging with the concept of virtues, by looking at it from a virtue-oriented perspective, we can really, and that requires engagement with philosophers and ethicists, of course, that requires some work to be done on this, some discussions, some more debates, then we could appeal to people's values through virtues. And then, so the individual value shift I've just discussed, and I would like to briefly touch upon a collective value shift towards sustainability, which first we have lots of individual personal norms. They're all different. At some point, some people start developing this shared sense of some sustainability values. And this community might not be too big, but it's growing. And then there are four factors that influence the growth of this community of sustainability values, which are political factors, economic factors, legal factors, and the environment, of course. So how do our policymakers view climate change? Do they really put an effort into the message to the people that we have to do something about our environment, or are they, like in my country, which is Russia, they're not really engaged with this kind of issues? People don't really hear things like this from the politicians. Economics, like things like carbon tax, things like different sorts of monetary incentives that can trigger certain people to get more inclined to be more inclined towards sustainability values. Legal frameworks. A small step aside here, I was working at the Secretariat for the United Nations Secretariat, and I helped to write a zero draft of the Secretary General's report on intergenerational solidarity and the needs of future generations. And this was an excellent example of how a concern, a value, a concern for remote future generations was recorded in an international document. And then people, of course, are going to refer to, future agreements are going to refer to this report. And it's clear how these concerns that were initially raised by civil society in 2012 Rio conference by the Children and Youth Group, how they were recorded they start getting recognized by legal framework. So law indeed has a very important role to play in spreading sustainability values. And of course, environment, as I just mentioned, if climate change is at the doorstep, it's very hard to deny it. And of course, our views, our beliefs about the problem, they change with that. If you feel discouraged, don't, because now I have the last part, which is dedicated to the questions of how do we proceed? How do we really engage with values? I hope I managed to convince you a little bit that values are important and that there is indeed another way of thinking about climate change other than, as Henrik mentioned, economics, politics, technology, innovation kind of discussions and frameworks. I have three suggestions on how to proceed. First, I believe it's really important to build a strong moral case for individual actions. I took a first step by bridging values and virtues, but it's not a one-person job at all. It requires a lot of cooperation, and it requires environmental ethicists, environmental philosophers, climate ethicists to come together to think about it. We really need a further development of our moral theories and to understand better what kind of guidance do we have here, what is morally right to do. And some work has already been done on this, and it's great. The first steps are being taken. Stephen Gardner, Dale Jamieson, Ronald Sandler, quite a few philosophers are working on this. I'm being hopeful that by the time they come up with something conclusive, it's not going to be too late. The second point, I believe it's important to identify gaps in the dominant system of values and then create a shared vision of what sustainability values should be. And I'm going to talk about this in a second. And finally, the third point is it's important to identify what actors are involved in a value shift and to which extent. More importantly, how can each actor take values into consideration during their work or life? So on the second point, sustainability values, I believe that there are at least three gaps in the dominant system of values. By the dominant system of values, I mean the Western system of values, mostly in developed states. And I don't believe it's fair to engage people from developing states and to ask them to change their values or to tell them what to do, because indeed there are different development paths and their paths should be respected and supported. If developed states want something else to come out of it than the regular fossil fuel dependent path. Gaps in the dominant system of values are consumerism, and there's a lot of literature on that, overconsumption. There's a movement for sustainable consumption, quite a few discussions, so I'm just going to briefly indicate it as one of the gaps. Second gap is lack of concept of individual responsibility for the global environmental crisis. As individuals, we don't feel responsible for a sinking island in the Pacific in 200 years. We don't feel responsible because there is no clear connection. I mean, science tells us that there is a connection, but it's not like Jack stole a cow from John and Jack has to pay John back for the cow or go to prison or do something else humiliating. Right now, there is a connection, but it's so unclear and it's so new that even though science managed to prove it, philosophers and moral theorists have not yet caught up on that. They still need to find out, okay, how do we hold someone accountable and to what extent does individual responsibility go here? And finally, my favorite, I believe that we have an underdeveloped sense of concern for remote posterity. When we speak about future generations, again, as part of my UN work, I was surprised how much attention UNICEF, which works with children's issue, how much attention UNICEF paid to the report, and they thought that report on intergenerational solidarity was supposed to be about children. And it's true, it's fair to an extent. Our future generations are young people, but we should not forget that future generations are also people who are going to live in 200 years from now and 100 years from now. As you might know, as you probably know, the IPCC's projections have been that really serious consequences of climate change are likely to appear by about 2100, in 100 years. It won't be our children living. We're losing the connection with those remote people living in the future, and that's why we care less. So we don't have a strong connection with these, with our remote posterity, and it's not that we're bad people and we don't have this connection. It's just naturally, historically, that's how it's been evolving, and that's normal. But now we're facing a new type of crisis, and we have to think more about this. Earth Charter is a powerful source of global ethic in the context of climate change, but it's not enough. Earth Charter outlines different principles, different kind of moral, a moral stand on global sustainable development. But still, it requires more involvement of all parties, and it requires involvement of climate and environmental ethicists to create a common vision of sustainability. right now we have an understanding of, more or less an understanding of how the value shift is happening, but we don't have a moral guidance of where we are going with this. That's to put it really plainly. And I'd like to finish with the naming the actors who can be engaged in a value shift, who are engaged, whether they want it or not, which are, of course, individuals. As individuals, our values change. We can change other people's values or not. Of course, not acting would be supporting status quo, and that should have certain consequences. I was thinking about it from the perspective of a value shift which happened around slavery, abolition of slavery. So the person, at that point, though, lots of injustice was in plain sight. People could see it. So you had to have some kind of opinion about it. And if you did not have an opinion, that meant that you supported status quo in one way or another. And then, of course, it's not a very nice moral stand when we look at it from today. I believe that a very important actor would be non-governmental organizations and civil society groups. And I did part of my work on WWF and Greenpeace promoting sustainability values through their climate change campaigns, which could be we could discuss it during the Q&A session. Governments, of course, can promote values, but do they? That's another direction for research. What kind of values do governments stand for? Partisan divisions, differences between what different parties stand for, that could all be explored, but there's not much literature connected to sustainable development here. International organizations, of course, are important promoters of sustainability values, and with a question mark, private sector. Some businesses, as you know, right now are developing according to very environmentally conscious business plans. And some private sector can indeed advance sustainability values, but not all of them do. In the end, I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that all these organizations, all the businesses, NGOs, governments, they all consist of individuals, which makes individual value shift a precondition to everything else. And this is the thought I'd like to leave you with and end my presentation here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It was a very interesting and thought-provoking presentation. I want to start off by pushing you a little bit on that very last point that you made about the sort of importance of value shifts in general and how it, at the end of the day, comes down to individual value shifts. You did talk a little bit about it in terms of what sort of shapes individual value shifts, introspection and interaction with other people and personal experiences and so forth. But if we dig a little bit more into that, what would you say are some of the sort of main shapers of our individual beliefs, whether it's sort of pro-sustainability or anti-sustainability or whatever it is? Why do we, at the end of the day, believe what we believe? What does the literature tell us about that?
Well, social sciences, of course, looked into that, and according to social psychologists, our main value system is formulated in the first 20 years, 20-30 years of a person's life. A lot depends on upbringing and, of course, on structural factors, what kind of environment you live in, what your parents believe in, what you were told to believe in. So that is one of the most important periods in one's life. And that's why I suppose a lot of messages on changing values are directed at young people. For example, the Nobel Prize winner Pachauri, who was the head of the IPCC, and they won Nobel Prize in 2007 for the work of Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He was, when he gave an interview about what in his opinion should be happening with climate talks, he was like, "You should not focus on climate talks right now. You should focus on something more, on something deeper than political discussions. And values should change from consumption society to more sustainable society." And he underlined that indeed it's the young people who are going to be the catalysts of this change, because the people who are now taking decisions, they were born into different into a different system of values, into a different context. They didn't have the climate change so as such a pressing issue in the 50s or 60s, for example. So yes, younger age, focusing on younger people. Is that the answer to your question?
Right. I mean, it sort of draws the attention to education, and since we are in the university, we obviously think that education is important. But sort of a counter argument to what you just said is that if we go back to the birth of the environmental movement in the 1960s, we have heard that the young generation will solve the problem, and you know it's the older people that are the obstacles here. And since 1960 to 2014 or 2015 now, we're sort of 2 or 3 years generations down the road. And those sort of young people that always supposed to save the day haven't really done it. So is there any reason to think that, you know, this young generation will be anything different from their parents or grandparents when it comes to sort of environmental sustainability more broadly?
It's an excellent question. I think you can have many different views on that. My personal view would be that, yes, it will be different now because the awareness about climate change and the scientific proof of the problem, it's very hard to deny them at this point. It's not like it was 40 years ago when things were uncovered, but they were still not. It was not possible to convince so many people. It was hard to convince everyone that that's the big problem. So right now, I think lots of young people are being brought up in a context when they know that resources are finite on our planet. They're not unlimited as we used to think, as people used to think before. And we each have certain individual responsibilities to do something about this. I think the context and the work of scientific community have really changed the situation for the present young generation. If people consider themselves reasonable young people, then they would act on the problem.
This one, I don't know if you, so it might be an unfair question, I don't know if you sort of directly looked at that in your research, but one of the major differences between North America and Europe on climate change has to do with the debate around the science of climate change. The scientific foundation in the United States is still by a large segment of the population much, much more contested than it is in many parts of Europe. Now, you know, there are also a fair amount of climate skeptics in Russia as well. So how would you say that the debate around the science of climate change impacts what you just said in terms of values, in terms of individual values and individual and collective value shifts?
If I just may quickly respond to the Russian case. I just published an article on ethics in Russia's climate politics, on the role of ethical concerns, concerns of justice. It was about international politics on the international arena, but I also kind of looked into the national policies that are in place. My conclusion was that concerns of justice and in the way that they are presented in UN discussions, for example, or at the international arena, they are pretty much absent from the debates surrounding climate change in Russia. Moreover, Russian scientists, scientific community, there is a part which supports the IPCC findings. There's still a strong part which says no, it's actually not happening. And of course, it's a bit ridiculous, but it still has a very important it plays an important role in shaping public opinion, because science in Russia is something that we like. People in Russia are proud of the scientific community that we have, and people tend to believe what scientists say. So of course, it has a negative influence on people's values, on their beliefs, underlying beliefs, and they would not have any incentive to act on climate change. But the thing is that the debate in Russia is reshaped in a way that it still encourages people to act, but not because of climate change, but because this is our national natural heritage. So they just reshape the debate and mobilize people on the basis of, this is something that we have to leave to our children. We have to preserve this forest because it's a nice thing to do. We have to preserve our animals. So it's just to say that different frameworks are in place in different contexts. An international context has one framework and it mobilizes some actors, but it doesn't mean that exactly the same framework should mobilize and change people's values in each country. I believe it's okay to adapt it to adapt the message and then the framework to the country-specific context.
Absolutely, but I agree with that. But is there anything that makes one sort of framework more robust than another? I definitely agree with you that this is not a one size fits all. The world is too large and too diverse for that. But those that sort of promoted the issue of sustainability and sustainable development early on argued that one of the benefits of the concept of sustainable development was that it was broad, it was malleable, you can turn it into many things, it was not rigid, it could be adopted and so forth. But you have more and more critics who are saying that the concept of sustainable development have become so broad, so elastic, that it can mean virtually anything, and therefore it's not a particularly useful tool anymore. So is there something here in this sort of value transformation in terms of frameworks that might make some frameworks more robust or more better than others?
I have a pluralistic approach to this. I think that different frameworks have their merit and they can be more or less successful in different contexts. The framework of sustainable development in Russia is very disadvantaged because the translation sounds very silly. So people just don't really... They're like, what do you want me to do? What is this thing about? So I just think that it doesn't matter in which name people do the right action. Right now there's, for example, a strong campaign to support the Amur tiger, which was almost extinct a decade ago. And WWF has started a huge campaign which was supported by the citizens. There's a lot of private donations to this campaign, but it can be called as an action as part of biodiversity conservation and protection, which is part of sustainable development. But WWF preferred to reframe it as, let's protect our tiger, let's protect our national heritage. So yeah, different contexts, different frameworks, they can be more or less efficient, but I just don't think it's necessary to stretch one to make sure that it is present everywhere, because it doesn't necessarily work the same everywhere. Yeah. Thank
you. So in your research, do you make any regional comparison or international comparison between countries as to what kind of environmental values different countries have that's independent from the level of economic development and the level of education of their citizens?
I wish, but the work that I did was the first stake to try to develop an interdisciplinary framework, and this kind of work would be certainly something very interesting to look at once more or less the idea of what kind of values we're discussing, how we're discussing them once it's in place. But here, there's been very important work done by Ronald Engelhardt on different mapping different cultural values. And I'm sure that work on sustainability values can take a lot of useful insights from that map. And he maps it according to regions and does inter-regional comparisons.
First of all, thanks for your talk. This is fascinating. But going back to the frameworks idea and whether or not one is needed for the entire global people or whether a more regional or nationalistic approach is more useful, I was just curious about your research on Greenpeace and WWF. So you were saying in the Amur campaign, they sold it in terms of nationalistic pride to the Russians. Did they, in order to get funding for that campaign from the U.S. and from the Europeans, did they then change how they framed the need to save the tiger?
Yes.
And how so? And is the way that they changed it then in that case, is that something that's a more general pattern? Do you always change it this way for the Americans and this other way for the Europeans?
Indeed, there are changes, and you can clearly see them in how different campaigns are formulated country to country. In Russia, it was more intuitive, from what I understand, and it took them maybe 10, 15 years to just find their way. WWF, when they finally came into Russia in the early 90s, they were still trying to see what works, what kind of what appeals to people, what appeals to governments, what appeals to businesses, what doesn't. They found their niche, which is more appealing to national pride kind of context. But if you look at campaigns to save different animals, including the Amur tiger in Europe, you can see the message is different. It's linked to climate change. It's linked to habitat loss, to other issues of biodiversity loss, because these are the frames that appeal to people in Europe. In the U.S., probably as well. I haven't looked into the U.S. case. But in fact, the work that I did on WWF and Greenpeace was more to look at their climate campaigns from the period between 2008 and 2013, so 6 years. And I did a qualitative analysis. I did a content analysis of what kind of messages are present in these campaigns, what kind of values these organizations promote. Because I was like, oh, these are the most likely ethical advocates, these are the most likely actors to advance sustainability values. And my findings were discouraging. Yeah. Because if you look, I'll just give one example. I did part of the work on counting the number of times the word was mentioned. So the word energy in both campaigns, the word energy was mentioned 21,000 times. You want to guess how many times the word justice was mentioned? 11 times the word justice was mentioned by both WWF and Greenpeace. So you can see that they really frame the debates in terms of economic activities, in terms of energy transition. I don't say this is wrong. I'm just saying that if these organizations are the most likely ethical advocates of sustainability values, then we're not going far with this.
Hi. I was just wondering, do you think that social movements can help provide the impetus for value shifts, like you were saying, like big disasters like Hurricane Katrina have? And if so, are there any you'd recommend that or can show as an example are being the most effective, or what other things do you think provide these sort of impetuses?
I totally agree that, yes, social movements, they have a strong potential to change people's values, and that's what they did since the American social movement, social and environmental movement emerged after the Second World War. Lots of people changed their ways of thinking about the environment, their beliefs, and their values changed because of that. In terms of specific recommendations, I think you might want to look at this work, which I just discovered. It's called Common Cause. It was written by a WWF, Oxfam, Greenpeace, and Friends of the Earth organizations. And it's specifically on values and it's a social take on values. And they are looking at how they can incorporate values into their campaigns, which is an absolutely excellent work. And one of the ways that they approach the subject is by using different frames in their messages, using deeper frames, appealing to people's underlying values, but not in a marketing sense, which is quite superficial, rather to look at how to take values into consideration. So if you're interested in how social movements should incorporate these ideas, this is one way to go. I don't have, as I said, any specific recommendations except for one, that the organizations themselves, NGOs, they should ask themselves what do they stand for, and have they not shifted quite so close to the governments as non-governmental organizations, have they not shifted too close to to the business as usual approach, and are there stands not too careful because you're trying to preserve the organization rather than the earth.
Just to follow up, so if we decide to say that the maxim, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, if we decide that that's not true, I guess the ways to teach an old dog new tricks, a.k.a. everyone who's above the age of 20, whose values have been already established, would you say the ways of doing that are disasters, unfortunately, social movements, anything else?
Awareness raising would probably be my first pick, because awareness raising and encouraging democratic deliberation about these issues. Of course, things are happening everywhere around the world. Natural disasters are happening, and it doesn't mean that they have to happen in front of your door to make people think about it. But the current framework, unfortunately, encourages people to focus on what's important right now and often ignore news from people who, like regions who are affected by climate change. So some kind of approach that can be facilitated by governments, that can be encouraged by NGOs to encourage deliberation about these issues, to encourage talking about this, and raising awareness, of course, continuously.
All right. Thank you very much. Please help us thank Katya for coming here today, and thank you.
Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Dr. Katya Vladimirova, visiting scholar at Boston University's Center for the Study of Europe. Dr. Vladimirova's lecture was titled, The Global Environmental Crisis, Is There a Place for an Individual Response? Tonight's moderator was Henrik Selin, Associate Professor of International Relations at Boston University's Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda with help from Paul Kalo. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.